Thank you for joining us for this Prima podcast. My name is Taekwon Gilbert. I am the education coordinator at Prima and the moderator for today's podcast. October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. National Cybersecurity Awareness Month was designed to increase awareness regarding the significance of cybersecurity, as well as to provide the necessary resources to ensure people are safe and secure online. To commemorate the 20th anniversary of National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, Prima created a National Cybersecurity Awareness Month podcast series. Each week during the month of October, Prima will feature podcasts that share important information about cybersecurity. On this podcast, Kirsten Simonson, AVP and Cyber Lead for Travelers Insurance, explains the importance of public entities implementing multi-factor authentication. Please enjoy the podcast. Thank you for joining us today, Kirsten.
Thanks for having me, Taekwon. I'm really happy to be here.
No problem. To start, what is multi-factor authentication, or MFA?
Yeah, that's a great question. Multi-factor authentication, or MFA for short, is an important security control that asks a user to essentially validate their identity with more than just a standard login ID and password to gain access to a system. So when you think about traditional methods of gaining access, which required a username, which may be assigned to the user or developed by the user, and a password often developed by the user, MFA takes this a step further, but by requiring one or more additional identifiers for them to gain access, which can be in the form of something you are, like a biometric identifier, fingerprint, eye scan, or something you have, like an access code that's generated by a smartphone app or software token, or maybe a badge with an embedded chip or something similar to that. If you think about times when you've tried to log into any online account that you may have, you're sent a one-time code via text or maybe email, that's MFA. So really, it's taking that extra step, adding MFA, which contributes to the trust that you are who you say you are. And this is just a part of a layered approach, which makes it more difficult for cyber criminals to gain access to your network or your information.
Now, why is MFA important? And why are passwords sometimes not good enough?
So let's start with the passwords and why they're not really good enough. Identity access management is incredibly difficult. And as humans, we have a tendency to reuse user IDs or passwords across multiple accounts or some variation, slight variation thereof. So think about it. If you were to use the same Office ID, username, or password as your login credentials for your social media or other non-work accounts, then it becomes easier for the bad guys to get your work credentials. Suffice it to say, please don't use your Office ID or password for anything other than your Office accounts. Another thing to think about is passwords are stored in the memory of your devices. So the malware that bad guys use can actually pull the IDs and passwords out of memory with clear text, which can result in this information being used for various reasons, including financial gain, such as putting it up for sale on the dark web. So the point of MFA or cyber defense is really to increase the time and the energy resources needed to launch an attack to the extent that the criminal or the assailant decides, is it or is it not worth it? So when you improve your defenses, you're cranking up the friction an attacker must overcome to successfully execute on that attack. You become a higher hanging fruit or more difficult compared to other organizations that don't use similar safeguards. A significant number of attacks tend to be instances where cyber criminals are going to take advantage of the low-hanging fruit. So those organizations or those entities that aren't using or aren't implementing MFA, additional identifiers, they're not patching vulnerabilities, or they have other poor cyber hygiene practices, or other critical technologies are missing that really would help them be that higher hanging fruit. So just being very simple, MFA really creates that extra layer of defense that may cause the cyber criminals to think twice and go elsewhere. It's not a silver bullet. I don't want people to think that it's going to solve everything, but it is a very important component of a comprehensive strategic approach to cyber. As I mentioned, it's not a silver bullet. To that point, with MFA becoming more prevalent and being used more often, the hackers are now using social engineering techniques to obtain the MFA code, whether that might be through a fake login screen or encouraging users to approve a push. So it's important to emphasize that there are still human behaviors that can compromise MFA. So users need to be aware of those attacks as well. But even though those vulnerabilities exist, MFA is still a very, very solid control that's going to make it more difficult, make you higher hanging fruit, as we like to say.
Where within the network should you be sure to have MFA, and how easy is it to implement?
You know, that's a bit of a complicated question, but your network security professionals or your cybersecurity professionals, they're really going to be best suited to provide you with specific recommendations on where MFA should be placed, since each network is going to be different. But that being said, there are really two areas or two endpoints where additional focus really needs to be placed. You really need MFA when you have remote workers who are logging in, and you really need MFA for privileged administrators or people with privileged access. So if you have employees or contractors that are working off-site and can connect into your network, your office network, you want to make sure that that is a secure connection. So MFA is, again, going to help create that security around that access. When we think about administrative rights and the accounts that are assigned administrative rights, these are quite often the target of the attackers. So network administrators, essentially, they have the keys to the kingdom. These are the folks that can install software, create users, configure networks. So it's really important that there be an MFA challenge before they can do that. If the attacker is forced to deal with an MFA challenge, this is going to limit their ability to install malware or take over the system. It can be fairly seamless to implement MFA, but there can also be some challenges, and one of those is user resistance or integration issues. There are a lot of different solutions out there on the market today, and it can really depend on the operating system or the legacy systems that are in place. As one example, if your entity is running Office 365, which a lot do these days, basic MFA features are actually available to Microsoft 365 and Azure Active Directory users and administrators. So while some may think it's inconvenient, using it really doesn't have to be a lot of work. It can be as simple as getting a pop-up on your phone with a 6-digit code or whatever the code is when you log in, or some type of push notification. So it does take, you know, maybe a few extra seconds to enter that code or approve that access. For on-site access, a proximity badge or a badge with an embedded chip might be used to gain access. Typically, it's really the change to the process that's the hurdle. So training, the human element becomes a challenge. It's not really the technology itself that's complicated. But, you know, like I said, there, look to the tools that you have, your operating system, and see what's already available, and, you know, talk to your cybersecurity professionals.
Many public entities are working with very limited budgets. Is this process expensive?
It doesn't have to be. Like I said, some solutions may actually be free if you have less than 50 users. Like I said, Microsoft Office 365 offers it as part of a subscription. All you have to do is turn it on. But setting aside the expense of implementation, you know, let's say you are a larger organization and it's a little bit more complicated, I also encourage anyone to really think about or debate whether it's worth the investment to consider what the costs of a cyber attack are going to be for them in the absence of the tools that may have prevented or mitigated the attack. So for a government entity, it's important to keep in mind the costs associated with a ransomware attack are not limited to a ransom that may be demanded. Whether that ransom is paid or not really may not play into those costs. The costs that they may suffer are costs associated with the downtime they may experience. So what does a day or a week of lost productivity or revenue look like? Depending on the entity's preparedness, you know, the ability to be up and running can be hours to days to weeks to months. So what are going to be the costs associated with getting back to the point you were or better than the point you were before the attack? It's also important to think about what could be impacted. Is it your voter registration data? When you think about hospitals, schools, emergency response, utilities, some of this may be a lot more critical to being operational than others. And if it's critical that you remain operational, this is going to have an impact to the cost to making sure that that happens. So when you think about a single breach and the fact that it can result in significant costs and the damage is not limited to lost data, it can also extend to a loss of confidence by your constituents, the financial expenditures, legal challenges. So you're dealing with things like forensics costs, notifications, et cetera. I did do some research and pulled a couple of examples. Recently in August, there were published reports that indicated a ransomware attack suffered by Dallas impacted 27,000 people and had cost the city roughly $8.5 million at the time of that report. In May of 2022, the city of Quincy, Illinois, administrative systems were hit by a ransomware attack, and they authorized an emergency payment of more than $145,000 for cybersecurity consulting services, an additional amount for paying the ransom. Total amounts that they spent based on that article were around $650,000. So you have to really weigh the costs associated with responding to an event versus the costs associated with trying to mitigate or prevent the event from happening at all.
What else, in addition to MFA, can make security better?
So as I've alluded to throughout this conversation, that, you know, there is no single control or process, and MFA is one of those that's going to work by itself. You really need to take a multi-layer approach of different tools and resources to help make it very difficult for cyber criminals. So with multi-factor authentication, you're addressing your identity and access management solution. So you know who they are, what they're using, and that you're creating a trust factor. But you also need to think about what you have that you need to protect and keep it up to date with patching. And there are critical operating systems that maybe release regular patches, but you also may have software and tools that release a patch only when there's a vulnerability. So you need to understand or have a process in place for making sure that all of your critical infrastructure, your critical software is up to date and current. Training employees. This is probably one of the areas that I continue to see gaps in when I'm talking with people. You know, people don't know what they don't know. And so it's important that you help them understand what's important to you, what processes you have in place, and be able to identify when something maybe isn't right. You know, you think about simple phishing attacks. They're getting more and more complex and harder to recognize. And so training employees on how to recognize those and repetition is always good. So just employee training on what's important and why it's important. Incident response team, you know, a cyber attack or a cyber event is a crisis that needs to be managed in the same way public entities would be responding to a hurricane, floods, you name whatever type of event that's going on, that they need an incident response plan. So you need to have a plan in place that includes who's going to do what. When are they going to do it? How is it going to be done? So before, during, and after the event. You know, incidents quite often, cyber incidents, really tend to happen at the worst possible time. And even for a small entity, you don't want to rely on memory during a crisis. And I would be remiss if I didn't talk about investment in endpoint detection and response tools. This type of technology actually looks at behavior on your endpoint devices, such as your laptop, to help detect what's going on. So what activity is coming in, and is there something unusual happening that needs to be responded to? So it's going to help detect, and it's going to help mitigate the cyber threats. Those are the basics.
Thank you for tuning in to Prima's National Cybersecurity Awareness Month podcast series. Should you have any questions regarding the podcast or any podcast in this series, please email education@primacentral.org. To learn more about Prima's educational resources, please visit primacentral.org. Thanks again.